something else. I'll just make a profit. So I'll
do my thing.
You know what Donna's going to say about it?
Carl Barth, say you have a relation.
Do you know what Donna's going to say about it?
Church history mentioned. There are three surviving copies that he knew of. Sabinus' book.
Trinitarianism.
One's in Fine Church. One's in the Library of Congress. And one's in a private collection.
You've ignored the book. You can order it up.
Have they finally got it out? I'd like to read that. Because what we should. In Schaff's book, he tells, here are these heretical statements. God indwelt the man Christ Jesus.
Colossians 2:9.
Schaff quotes him. And in the quote, it's like, my, I'd like to see the sentence after that.
Yeah.
To see what he was really, really saying.
Yeah.
Because all they do is say, well, that heretic Sabinus.
Yeah.
Yeah. That impure cavalier, if you can put Calvin called him.
What was ironic is, in reading the account, he almost didn't go to the Calvinist church that day. If he hadn't, he would have gone right on to He just decided to stop in, and he was recognized, and that was it. He was just traveling. He could have just kept going.
I haven't heard all the details.
Moral of that story.
I think that Schaff mentioned that in his church history about Sabinus Machiavelli, or some of the letters or something.
Some other question. The moral is our Swiss church shouldn't linger in Zurich too long.
Yeah. Zurich is not the
same.
He was on his way through to another city. If he would have got to this other city, he would have been.
Was it Zurich or Geneva at that time?
Geneva.
It was Geneva. Yeah.
Okay.
Zurich was the away from there, probably.
I'd like to just restudy all of that again, too. It's so interesting. Getting more
inside. Learn something.
Yeah.
Well, by the time we get all through, we'll be reading the church history book, the grammar book.
Yeah. Somebody ain't going to like that.
Who's that?
Probably all of this.
Well, we left off talking about these infinite constructs, trying to get a handle on what these things really are. And we're about page 128 on section 115. And I suppose the best thing I could say is don't necessarily try to force this into an English mold. Take it as it comes, and we'll work with it, try to feel it out. But it's different the way English does things, it's different the way Greek does things. And probably any other language you're familiar with. Maybe Arabic or something, I don't know. Even there is different. So, we've already talked about the basic form of the infinitive construct and the form that it takes when you use the suffixes. Now the question is, what do these things mean? How are they used? Quote B here, you see, would be my writing. And it's making kind of a noun out of the, my is an adjective. Possessive adjective, and so you're describing what kind of writing, my writing, or the writing of me, if you wanted to use a genitive phrase on it. And that may be more akin to the way Hebrew is looking at it, because we've already seen pronominal suffixes stuck onto nouns. My horse, for example. Well, this says this is my writing. Susie, my horse, quote B, my writing. It just happens that this noun has got a verbal, a verbal idea to it. Concept of verbal action that's being nominalized, I guess you would say, but made a noun. Okay. And that's what essentially infinitive is. In English, to see, you can construct a sentence like, to see is wonderful, or something like that. to see is functioning as a substantive, is functioning as a noun, because you're using the predicate adjective to describe it. Now it's very, very similar. So that's where similarity between English infinitives and Hebrew infinitives should probably be focused. There are differences, though, as you can see, in exact rendering and how the word is worked. So, and all these are likewise. Kot Vaka would be your masculine singular writing. Kot Vek would be your feminine singular writing. Kot Vo, his writing. Kot Va, her writing. Kot Venu, our writing. Kot Vachem, etc. Kot Vachem, Kot Vam, and Kot Van. Now, when the infinitive construct stands before a following noun, that noun may be either the subject or object in the infinitive, although the former is more likely. So, if you have an infinitive construct, this is where the ambiguities arise. If you've got a subject on it, it's not so much a problem. You don't have a subject. But if a noun follows this infinitive construct, you have an ambiguity, because it could be that the noun is the subject of the infinitive, or it could be that the noun is the object of the infinitive, the one that receives the action. And it says the former is more likely, and it being the subject of the infinitive is more likely than the object. And that's probably because it's more often used that way. But look at the example here. Ketov ha'ish. Ketov ha'ish. The man's writing, or the act of writing. The man's act of writing. This one's not so much of a problem, because you don't write men. So it's not the writing of a man. I mean, men are written. But if it was a... Well, this one, just the nature of the verb, is going to resolve most of the ambiguities here. Because if you said, but if you had Ketov ha'sefer, the writing of a book, that might be the object of that. And most likely, because books don't write. In other words, the book didn't write, but the book was written. So it means, but if you look at this next example, ha'rog ish could either mean killing a man or a man's killing. So killing a man would make man as the object. So killing a man, you know, would be, you could say, is killing a man with evil or something like that.
Is it just because the verb love is irregular, they don't put something a little
time? Oh, yeah. It's too bad. Yeah, love would be more edifying, but the trouble is that love is a nasty verb as far as, you know, as we've seen. We didn't even get the verb love until a little while ago. And even among Wanaus, it's irregular. It's got mixed forms, and it's very few forms are accepted. And so that's why I'm sure that's part of the problem. The verbs to kill seem to be one of the most regular verbs in Hebrew. You know, and there's quite a few of them. Yeah.
Couldn't it also be an imperative to kill a man?
Well, it could be. It could be. The imperative form would be the same. Kill a man. That would be a possibility. The context would have to decide that. Usually the context makes that real clear, though, because if you use an infinitive, there are other things in the sentence and so forth. See, killing man, it doesn't stand by itself. It's got to have something else. But whereas if it's an imperative, it'll stand all by itself. So that will very seldom be a problem. Now, the ambiguity of the second example is grammatical as well as semantic. In other words, semantically, it's possible, because of the nature of this particular verb, you can kill a man and a man can kill. So the verb kill can take both an object or a subject, and this particular subject could be appropriate or as a subject or an object. So semantically, it is ambiguous. Could be either way. And grammatically, it's also ambiguous. In other words, the grammatical rules aren't going to tie it down for you. So you're not going to be able to look at grammatical rules to nail it down. Infinitive is in construct, hence its name, with its subject, as in the first example. But in the second, the word ish should probably be regarded as an object noun, not construct, when it is the object, especially since it requires F when made definite. Now, if you have a definite, that's part of the ambiguity, because he chose an anarthous noun. If you have an articular noun, then you're okay. And that's why ketov ha'ish is no problem, because if it was ketov, if it was writing a man, which would be impossible anyway, you'd have to have an F. Yeah. So look at these two examples down here. Harog ish versus harog et ha'ish. Harog ish could be to kill a man, and then harog et ha'ish would be to kill the man. Now the second one isn't ambiguous, though. But that first one, harog ish, is ambiguous. It could mean to kill a man, killing a man, or a man's killing. And man, in other words, the man's killing of the dog or something like that, or the man's killing is evil, you know, this man's doing the killing.
So when they're saying, like here, to kill a man,
mm-hmm.
Is that kind of like a dictionary form of it, whereas in translation you would be a lot more along the lines of killing a man?
Probably, most likely. In some cases, you could probably go both ways in English. For example, if you had a sentence, "Harog ish ra,"
yeah, to kill a man.
Yeah, to kill a man is evil. You could say either "to kill a man is evil" or "killing a man is evil" in English. You'd probably do it both ways.
Yeah.
In other words, Hebrew isn't making that kind of a distinction.
Yeah,
as we would in English.
I was curious because in the one case, you know, same phrase, killing a man, the other one,
yeah,
kill a man.
Yeah, I think he's just doing that to give you the optional.
Probably to kill a man would be if you're talking about an abstract action.
Yeah, I think that's the main thing. If it's an abstract action, then you're all right. But if you're talking, if you put a suffix on it, for example, now it's somebody's my killing the man and so forth. Now you can't say my to kill the man.
Right.
Say my killing the man. So I think that's the main thing they offer to killing most of the time because they're using suffixes all the time. They offer the ing form, you know. But if you're dealing with kind of a raw conceptual statement, you know, talking about the concept and so forth, then you may be...
So that's sort of parallel to in the Greek infinitive, where the two is not considered really a part of it.
No, it isn't. It isn't.
And yet we need it in English to understand what's going on.
Sure. In English, it sets it off and tells you it's an infinitive and gives you the information that it's functioning like a noun. Otherwise, if you take the two off there, kill a man, that can be imperative now in English.
I wonder what the difference would be too far afield. But to be killing the man, what do we call that?
Well, that's a matter of aspect.
Yeah.
That would be giving you a progressive aspect to the thing. And we will see something like that. Well, it's not exactly like that, but we get into that area when we start talking about infinitive absolutes, and they have ways of giving a very powerful progressive aspect to something.
I see.
And in English, sometimes the King James says, killing, you should be killed, or something like that.
Right.
That's infinitive absolute. We're going to get to that a bit later on. And as far as the other, I think you might see it... No, you can't do too much of this. You're going to have to do most of that with context in Hebrew. In Greek, of course, you can do that with the difference between a present and an aorist. Okay? Now, there's also a thing where you get into passive, too. To be killed by a man, to be killed,
right,
rather than to kill. We have to use the nifal form for that. That's where those derived verbs come in. You notice we haven't had any passage or anything yet,
yeah,
but we'll get them. They're there. So take heart. We'll not only find passages, but we'll find intenses and causatives. Reflexives also, which is more like middle.
Is there a name for what we're dealing with here, or are all of those derived forms based off of how's the terminology being used here? I know there's like seven different categories.
Yeah, seven categories. You mean where did the words come from?
No, what are we doing right now with the, what are we in right now? What's the name of what we're doing here?
The name of this is just an infinitive construct. That's the whole category.
What about the perfect and imperfect and all the rest of that?
Well,
just a general...
Those designations don't apply. This is kind of a separate thing. In fact, if you look back on your paradigm, does this book have a full paradigm for a strong verse? I think it does. They do it a little bit differently in different books, but... Okay, back here.
Sound.
You'll see a breakdown here. Well, let's see. This one, it doesn't give a whole paradigm. Well, what they do is give you perfect, imperfect, justice, imperative, infinitive construct, infinitive absolute, and participle.
Right.
So those are all the different kinds of verbs you're going to have. But notice perfect and imperfect are two different categories.
Sure.
And then now this is a completely different category. In other words, you don't have perfect or imperfect participles or perfect or imperfect infinitive constructs.
Sure. Yeah, I understand that. What I'm saying is now across the way here, he lists six more categories.
Yes.
Fall, PL, 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 PL. What's the name of the seventh? Just the regular straight, what we've been doing.
Oh, call.
Call.
Okay, I'm sorry.
That's
a simpler version of that. Call doesn't mean the simple. It means the simple
okay.
form.
Okay.
A call. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
I want to know where my parents are.
Yeah. Okay, we're dealing with call now.
Yeah.
And of course, the call, the nipal is the passive
yeah.
form of the call.
And an intensive. And
right. Theo is intensive. And the pool is the feel. Well, yeah, pool is the passive of the intensive, and then you get the his feel is positive, pool fall is the passive of the positive,
yeah.
And then his pile is your reflective.
Right.
Yes, you can do it to yourself. So.
Yeah, I don't know if we've ever introduced the
pool. Okay.
Call.
No, yeah, okay.
I was going to ask the same question.
Oh, I'm glad you asked that question. I just assumed most of the books write that out.
Yeah,
you know,
it's never been written out.
But that's. Yeah. Okay. That's a flaw somewhere.
In the back of the appendix.
They mention it here in chapter 40 when they talk about PL. They refer to the call.
Right.
So they'll get to it. I think the reason they haven't said anything so far is because we haven't had anything else to compare it with.
All your appendixes start appendix B call verbs.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. All the appendixes all the call, and you have a complete.
Verbs are listed. Yeah. Well, the start of the English glossary hasn't broke down.
Well, we dealt with stated verbs, and that was getting similar to that.
Some of the other
folks
have stated that. But we haven't really gotten to the
end. No, we haven't gotten to their formal passive construction. And chapter 37 is where it all begins. And there you'll see the term call introduced and so forth. So we'll get there.
I take it, Hayah won't apply to all these categories.
No, Hayah won't have. Hardly anything but the call, I don't think. No, I don't think there's any. Well, there might be a positive. There might be a hip field, but I think there is a hip field. I think there's some debate about whether Yahweh comes from the hip field or the call. So I think there's. I don't know if there's many incentives for me or not, though. Okay. But, call is what we're talking about here. Yeah. All right. Then, when pronouns are involved with the infinitive construct, the arrangement of subject and object is a little more complicated, but the following example should make the situation clear. So basically, if you've got a suffix on it, that's going to be the subject. And if you've got something else there, that'll be the object. So that's the basic philosophy. To go through here, Vargi et Aish, my killing a man. Now, this is pretty clear that the here at Yola's on the infinitive construct would indicate that that's the subject, so it's my killing. Or, and then S Aish, the S there is going to be your object marker, so there's no ambiguity on this one at all. Okay, Harog Aish Otho, the man's killing me. Okay, now on this one, how would I know that it's not... I guess it's pretty obvious. How would I know that Ish is not the direct object of this thing? You've got Otho already there, and there's no S on Ha'ish. It's articulate, so there really isn't else you can do it. It's unambiguous.
Strange phrase.
Yeah.
We would say the man's killing of me.
Probably in English, yeah. The man's killing of me was a dastardly deed. But you wouldn't be saying there
well, I don't know, Paul being dragged out of the city.
Well, yeah, after you feel resurrected, sure. Okay. All right. Shomri et HaTorah, my observing the law. That's analogous to that first example. We've got a suffix on the infinitive construct and on the S. No problem. Shomri Otho, my observing him. Again, no problem because the S is there and nothing to. And then Shomro Othi, now just reverse it, his observing me. So now the his, we know it's his observing me because the third person is on the suffix of the participle, I mean of the infinitive construct, so we know that that's the subject of it. Kethol Dahar, to write a word. To write a word.
So we're writing it, or writing?
A word's writing is possible also, but words don't write, so that's the reason that.
That's kind of strange, though.
Yeah.
Well, the small thing, because what we're saying is that the, like, in Shomri Otho, it's a construct, and if it were a normal construct, we would expect that instead of Otho, it would be who.
Oh, yes. But the thing is, it's not a construct under those circumstances. If the thing is the object, And then that's why he said up here, you should not consider it a construct. I mean, it's being construct with an absolute. Of course, especially once you put a suffix on it like this. So for that suffix is kind of the absolute of the construct. In effect, that's the thing that's showing you the subject of it.
You got to take the translation wise. His observing of me. You know, mm-hmm. I mean, that would be a proper way of translating.
Mm-hmm. So it's observing of me.
Like him. Yeah, it's just that we have a verb involved instead of a noun.
Mm-hmm.
And so it takes on that subject, and it's subject to mm-hmm. take on
that. See, we've got a mix here. We've got a thing that's acting like a noun in part and like a verb in part. Because it's acting like a verb because it's taking an object, O-T, there. It's acting like a noun because it's got a noun-type suffix on it.
Is this what they do instead of having... Because we're having a participle-type meaning in here.
Mm-hmm.
Is that what they'll do instead of having... I mean, you wouldn't have a participle in the construct then, too, would you?
No, you won't have... This is the way that's going to be covered.
Okay.
Now, what... I have a question here on to write a word. Mm-hmm. Result devar.
Mm-hmm.
Could that be writing a word?
Yes, it could be. It could be writing a word also.
With these infinitives, then, there's no declension for
no.
the person?
No.
So how would you say...
The only thing that person comes in is by the suffix on it.
Right.
You get to get the subject of that definitive idea. That's the only place where you get that. But if there's no suffix on the thing, then see, that opens it up.
How could you then say... Oh, I guess you just use a straight participle to say they were writing a word.
Yes, they were writing a word. You go to a participle.
Or no. Just a plural participle.
Yeah, but if you wanted to say their writing of a word or their writing a word was sinful or something, then you would use their definite construct. Because now that verbal idea is functioning like a noun.
So when we're dealing with just ketho, with no suffix,
mm-hmm.
is that going to to say he was killing a man, and that what you couldn't say something like Haya Harog Ish, you couldn't say that. What he was killing a man.
Yeah, not Harog. You would go to Horeg again. You would go to a participle in there.
Okay.
Because in that case,
and then
in that case, that's your main sense of structure. And see, what we're dealing with infinitives, we're dealing usually with an infinitive clause of some sort of a, even if it's only a word long. I mean, it's functioning as a unit in relationship to the rest of the sentence.
So when we get an infinitive all by itself with no suffix,
mm-hmm.
then it must always be taken as a generalized.
Right. With the possibility, it may not have a suffix, but there may be a nominal subject for the infinitive that's given. In which case, you might have, for example, if it was, for example, up there, Harog-ish, that's not too good either. But suppose it was Harog Ha'ish, not Harog Es-Ha'ish. That would be the man's killing. And you wouldn't have any ambiguity there. That would have to be the subject because you didn't have an S. And that would be the subject of that infinitive idea, even though it didn't have a subject on it.
Could you say something like Shemuel Harog Agag something? Could you say Samuel's killing of Agag was good? Would you use
yes? That? That's what you would use.
So, you could have a named subject,
mm-hmm.
and then just use the strip thing with no
right.
other name.
Sure.
And then it would be the named thing's killing of so and so. You could also say the people's plural,
mm-hmm.
the killing of. The inhabitants of Jericho was good.
Yes.
And again, it would just be that stripped infinitive, no
right.
person, no number.
Yeah, there would be no reason to do that unless you had, if you wanted to say their killing
right.
of the people, then you'd use the plural suffix on it.
Right.
But then you'd be looking for who the they was from the context.
Exactly. You look at
started out.
Nominal, if you're told the name of the people or a person, or if you're told, you know, like the man or something like that, then you don't. The infinitive construct won't have the subject on it.
But then you
it provides that that's the subject of it.
Right.
There will be some ambiguity sometimes, though, because like with this Kapil Devar, for example, there's an ambiguity as to whether that Devar is the object or the subject or the infinitive. Of course, because of the meaning, semantically, it can't be anything else than to write a word. Words don't write. But in some other situation,
in a certain sense, they throw the construct idea in there then, because if you say Shimuel, Harod,
but you normally see in that the word order would probably be Harog Shimuel.
Okay, Harog Shimuel Ish.
Because it's a construct relationship.
Was justified.
Mm-hmm.
Something like that.
Okay.
You know, Samuel's killing a man was justified because of Agag, and God said kill him anyway.
Right.
Sure. The construct idea comes in English, we'd have to put apostrophe S. Samuel's killing of
right.
The man was. And so there's where that possessive construct idea is.
And it's a different construction in English, although even in English, you're still seeing that if you were to ask the question, who is the performer of the action, you still get the same answer in Greek or in English or Hebrew.
Right.
But the way that they're expressed is completely different.
Yeah, so it's kind of a genitive, attributive idea.
Yeah, and see.
Attributing an action to his credit or something like that.
And I guess this is, you know, if you follow the analogy previously, this isn't really that bad as far as what English does too. Samuel's killing of the man and so forth. Before we've seen it, you know, Harog Shibuel would be the killing of Samuel. You know, Samuel's doing it in this case, not Samuel being killed. There, you get an ambiguity also because of English. The genitive can be an object of genitive or a subject of genitive. And that precisely is what we're dealing with here, the problem. And that's in Greek too. You get objective, subjective, genitive. So maybe we could rejoice. Hebrew is a little bit less ambiguous in some respects. If you word it that way,
So the only place where this infinitive construct here, with any kind of a person, as far as a person or number type person, that is specified. It's always going to hold its same form and never be
right.
Or change at all.
Right.
And then only if we go over to a pronominal unstated subject
right.
Is it going to change in that only in respect to the ending.
Right, precisely. Now, it's an undeclinable, it doesn't decline. It's like a noun. And noun can take pronominal suffix, but the noun doesn't decline.
So we only have to learn one for each verb. Right,
right. You only have to learn one for each verb. And that's why, you know, the list there just gives you the infinitive construct and then just gives you one form, that's it. But then, of course, the complexities may arise from when you add the suffixes on, what happens to it. So, but that's pretty straightforward, too, once you learn the pattern, it's not bad. In other words, it's hard to go from a rogue to a horgi.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you don't really know to predict that the vowel pattern changes when you put the pronoun suffix on. But once you learn what that vowel pattern is, then yeah, it's pretty consistent for all the forms. Of course, now we're not talking about three hays and one hay, you know, one hay, two gutter, three hay words, or something like that. That's what we'll get. But then when we get to those, they'll just get to tell you what's the cut and cost of form. And they get rid of the regular. Okay. Well, that kathol devar is to write a word, or it could be theoretically a word's writing, but not practically. And then kathol etha devar, to write the word. Now we have to write the word, and etha devar is clearly the object, can't be anything else. And still, though, kathol is to write, or it could be writing the word, or to write the word. And now we've got kot vakah etha devar. You're writing the word. Now we have a stated subject for that. It's pronominal, but we do have a subject for it. And see, sometimes it has no subject at all. That's when there's no subject stated or implied at all, either in a pronoun or a stated noun, that's when you're dealing with a general concept like we say to write or write. But when you have a subject of some sort stated, either by a pronominal suffix or by some nominal element following it, in construct with it, you can just see this. Okay, sir. Yes,
Professor. Okay, in some things like
the phrase my observing the law, to be translated by observing of the law.
It's not bad. I don't think it's going to give you any problem. Because you see, what you're doing is using an objective genitive construction there. But it's not going to be a real problem, I don't think. You just have to be careful with English. The problem isn't so much with Ethan as with English. Be careful you don't tangle it up. If Ethan, you can construct sentences like, let's see, the killing of Samuel of a man. Now you've got of for both the, you've got an objective genitive and a subjective genitive there. The killing of Samuel was a man. You can stop and think about that. Does that mean Samuel killed a man or man killed Samuel? But, you know, we usually put, you know, the subject first and then the object, so normal word order like that. So you would say Samuel killed a man. But you can get into, you know, it's of in both places in English, and it's word order that's telling you in English which one is which. But no, it's not as flexible as Greek. It's more flexible than English, probably. I have to say it's more flexible than English. English is pretty rigid word order-wise. Hebrew is more flexible than English, but not nearly as flexible. Greek is not as flexible as they get. I don't know if there's many other languages that put subjects object. You know, there's some word order rules in Greek, but it's not very okay. But they've got so much precision with other things that usually the information will be there someplace. In other words, if the language is loose on word order, it'll probably be tight on something else. And if it's tight on something else, it'll probably be looser in word order. You know, that way you can facilitate getting more expression. You know, you don't want the language so rigid that you can't really express yourself with it. Yes, Tony.
I'm a little confused for myself.
Okay.
Is there a kind of infinitive that is not an infinitive construct?
Yes, an infinitive absolute. We haven't got to those yet.
Now, is that just a... I feel like I'm grabbing that there should be an infinitive. There's just an infinitive, and then an infinitive in a construct form.
Oh, no. It's not quite like that. The infinitive construct is not derived from, let's say, infinitive absolute or vice versa. They're kind of two independent things, and they're used for different grammatical areas. The infinitive absolute, you won't see nearly as often. It's got more of an emphatic type of use. I would characterize it overall as more of an emphatic type of use. This infinitive construct is the one that we're going to spend the most time with, because it's the one that's more like English infinitive or more like Greek infinitive. It's used in the places where we would use them the most. And then it kind of laps over into some other areas too. But there is an infinitive absolute in one form, I do. But fortunately, that infinitive absolute doesn't take, you know, it's going to be like this. It's going to have a fixed form instead of going to have a declining declension. Okay, well, those examples, so hopefully we're all clear to you now, except we've gone through them. Now, as a unit, the infinitive of phrase may be, so let's consider the infinitive phrase now, as a unit, that whole phrase may function in various ways. It may be the subject of a sentence. So remember, now your infinitive function like a noun, and all the adjectives with it are, you know, kind of tied together. You put brackets around them, as it were, and they function in certain positions. So as a subject of a sentence, told, you are observing the law is good, or it's good that you observe the law. Okay, you're observing the law is good, or it is good that you observe the law. You're observing the law. Here's a predicate adjective construction. And told is, you know, just like ha'ish, told, the man is good. Instead of ha'ish, now we have shemorka et ha'torah. So that whole thing is functioning like ha'ish did in the other sentence, and it's functioning as a subject of the sentence. This is happens to be a predicate adjective sentence structure. Or it can be the object of a preposition. Can be the object of a preposition. So here we have av mozaka oto, mozaka av oto, until you find him from matza. And so here we find until you find him. We have a second person masculine singular suffix on the infinitive construct. We need to indicate that it's the subject of that. So it's you, until you find him, O soul. There's your direct object of that infinitive phrase. And the whole thing is the object of the preposition, ah, until you find him. Okay. Or you might even say until you're finding it. Until you're finding it. That's the problem. The idea is until you're finding it, it just takes place, you know. Until you're finding it. The object of a verb also, though, can be the direct object. Lo yakolti shema. I was not able to hear. Okay, now yakolti is your finite verb in a sentence, and shema is your infinitive construct, but it's functioning like the object of that verb. So I was not able to hear. Okay, so I was not able, that's the verb. Lo yakolti, I was not able what? To hear. And this verb probably wasn't, I can't think of any other unable. This verb, I think, is only going to take infinitive as object, direct object. I can't think of anything else as it, because it's an auxiliary type of verb. So you can't use, I was not able a horse, you know, see, but I was not able to ride a horse, maybe. So I think that this would be the only kind of an object that finds for this particular verb. Either that or, you know, no object at all. But there could be other verbs too that, you know, take this as a direct object. That maybe it was good for that example we used, not as general. Okay, but the most frequent use of the infinitive construct is with prepositions le, le, and ke. Here they come again. The old le, le, ke. And this is the most frequent way you'll see these infinitive constructs used. We'll break it down into a couple categories here. A, with le and ke, the infinitive is the equivalent of an adverbial, mostly temporal clause in English. So here we get something into something like what we had in the last chapter, these temporal modifiers and so forth, temporal clauses. This is another way to do it. So we've got Kishomaru et Adavar. Kishomaru et Adavar. When he heard the word. Literally, it's like or as his hearing the word. Like or as his hearing the word. Or as his hearing the word took place. That's kind of the idea. As his hearing the word. When he heard the word. Or as his hearing the word. And then Be'omdi Lefanau, or when or while I stood before him. When I stood before him, or the literal, it literal be would be, how would you translate this real literally, but
in my standing.
Yeah, in my standing to his face. In my standing to his face, real literally.
Is he implying that the preposition including their
normal
meeting?
No, I don't think so. I think that I don't think these questions have lost anything. I just think that in English we have different ways of translating them. So, like this last example, you know, when or while I stood before him, their picture is in my before him. And so to them, they're just thinking in my standing before him. To us, we're thinking when I stood before him, because that's our idiom. So I think that's the same. I don't think the sense of these prepositions haven't been lost at all. Or as I, you know, he heard the word like or as, you know, like or as, it still got that same sense to it. Could, I don't think it really changed its meaning. It's just that being used with an infinitive construct now and so forth, English idiom to express the same idea is used with when or something like this. Well, this is a tough question. On this particular instance, I think that if you put it down literal, I would like to know that you really know how you would say that in English. Sometimes you can, you know, in other words, if you don't know the idiom and don't know what's really being expressed, you can sometimes go with a literal stilted translation and be right as far as your literal translation, but you still didn't get it. And so I think what I'd like you to do is, probably the best way is to give a literal and then give a paraphrase, you know, so I'm sure that you got that idea, connected that idea.
Yeah. Like this, the 1-4 on the bottom of 128. I just, it's difficult to understand how he got it is good that you observed it.
Oh, yeah.
Now I can see that the it must be referring to, and instead of having something, it being a pronoun for something before, it's the pronoun for something that follows.
Yeah.
You know, right. And good is your observing of the law is more literal.
Yes.
And I think it states it just as well.
Yeah. I think that if it states it just as well, and there's no problem, I'd stay with that. In fact, on the test, I would not want you really to say it is good that you observe the law. Probably that's not, you know, you might put that parenthesis afterwards or something, but you'd have a completely different structure. Like you say, you've got get out there, you've got an impersonal, pronoun, you know, and different construction. So you're observing the law is good, or good as you're observing the law, if it's good, fine, it's fine. because that's not gonna, that's not really straining English grammar at all, and it's still entering the sentence pretty accurately.
You're observing the law is good, probably. English wise is probably a lot better.
Yeah, you're observing the law is good.
Good as you're observing the law is. You get away with it.
Yeah, you get away. That's more of a poetic word order.
Well, yeah,
when you say that, you know, first of all, it's
poetic life.
Yeah, you know, if I walk in the door and say, good as you're observing the law, you know, you don't, you say, you know, he's talking funny. I mean, he's got a
Shakespearean deal.
Yeah. In other words, it's not what you say in normal conversation. But that's why I think this first choice, you're observing the law, is good. See, it is good that you observe the law. There's kind of an impersonal, there's another idiom that English uses, and Greek uses something similar to it, too. And it's kind of an impersonal pronoun type of idea.
Is there another way, then, that they can say, it is good that you observe the law?
Probably could do it with a key clause.
Yeah.
Probably just use... Trouble is you don't have a neuter in Hebrew, and you Greek would be a lot easier.
So you'd still have to say Tov Shamareka. Shamareka.
Well, you observe. You could take that.
You could just use a final verb.
Yeah.
That you observe the law is good, or something like that. You could do.
Good that you observe the law.
Or if you just want to say it is good that you observe the law.
So actually, really, he's missing.
Who told, or he told? I don't know if you use masculine or feminine there. I doubt that Hebrew would ever say it that way. They'd say it this way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But. We're just kind of playing the game now. What we're doing is trying to say we're putting an English idiom and saying,
right,
how could I have to get a Hebrew equivalent to this English idiom?
Yeah.
So what would probably be, I can just foresee the situation where somebody in Israel is trying to learn English and they know Hebrew, and they're saying, well, to put it into our idiom, we'd use an infinitive construct.
Yeah.
But you know, if you wanted a stilted translation in Hebrew of the English, it would be like this, you know.
isn't it focusing on the process of observing?
Mm-hmm.
And with a durative aspect?
Well, I don't know if it's always a durative aspect. I think just the action itself. See, the durative aspect, we'll get some ways to really nail that durative aspect down in Hebrew. It's a little bit different. You could probably use a participle more in Hebrew if you wanted to get a durative aspect. Or you stretch a participle with a verb by R or something, get a paraphrastic construction. There's some ways to do that. I think it's not saying it's not that, but I think it's just kind of talking about the action. It's more like an aorist, I think, in Greek. That's the action. It may be progressive. It may not be. It doesn't seem to really be emphasizing that at all. Just that this is the action, and it's more, you know, it's aorist.
Hebrew aorist.
Don't quote me on that. As far as discussing, you want to ask, what is the aspect of this action? It seems to be, it's not nailed down. It's definitely not clearly progressive, but progressive isn't eliminated. I think you really have to rely on context, and sometimes even that is not going to help you, because the intent is only to indicate the action takes place.
But see, what I guess part of the ambiguity here in this translational point of view, granted it's a fine point, is there's, when we're bringing this English translation over, unwittingly we're throwing tense ideas around.
Yes, we are.
Quite freely.
For example, in this case, you're observing the law is good. Because that gives a progressive aspect to it. You're observing the law.
And it also brings you contemporaneous.
Mm-hmm.
But it is good that you observe the law. Is that...
That's more of an error.
That you have observed the law, or
right,
that you are going to observe the law.
Right.
It is a good thing, and we all grant that you observe the law.
Yeah.
and yet we all can.
In that respect, that second translation is probably better to get the error idea of the definitive construct.
Mm-hmm.
And get that in-depth of that. However,
that's the only reason I was taking the time on it, because observing
we could choose that the languages are different, and they're not one-to-one. They're not really lining up where you can just say simply that this corresponds to this. The infinitive construct in Hebrew is often corresponding to idioms in English that sometimes use the ing form, sometimes just use the two two form of the infinitive, and they're just not 100% lining up. So I think all you can say is that you have to pick up some of those other things from the context of the Hebrew to decide whether you're dealing with more progressive aspect. Just what would be the, you have to start thinking in Hebrew to decide what would be the way in English I would express the city the best.
Would be safe to say that section here A, we're using the preposition,
mm-hmm.
way, we're using it in a circumstantial sense?
Well, in a way, yes. It's a circumstantial type of an idea because it's a temporal modifier that corresponds, like in Greek, to your circumstantial participle. Sure.
Because it's primitive when, even if you're putting the emphasis on time,
mm-hmm.
if we say it's in, we're putting the emphasis on position.
Yes, in a way you are. One has to perform, one has to perform. Both of them are going to kind of get it depends on the words that you're using with it.
Yeah.
These two constructions here, these constructions are very analogous to either circumstantial participle or genitive absolute in Greek, depending on what you stick onto it, what follows, and so forth. But it's the same kind of a function. But you see they're doing it with prepositional phrases and genitive, whereas Greek could do it with no prepositional phrase and a participle.
Is it simply one of those coincidences
of
lesson 28 in both books?
Yes, I'm sure it is. Yeah. It just happened to come out the same, But remember that...
28 is a perfect number,
When we're studying it, when we're studying these ideas of participles and infinitives, for Greek and Hebrew, don't line up exactly. Some of the constructions that we have infinitives for in Hebrew, we have participles for in Greek, and vice versa. So... they're not one-to-one even in terms of, we have to call things something, and I suppose the terms are just derived from what it seems to correspond to the most often or something. That,
although it's something of a strain upon the flesh, it's been real profitable to be paralleling the input going on.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think you gain something from that. The person who takes Greek Hebrew at the same time here carries a great load of work, but the comparison between the languages as he's going, I think it's good for you in the long run. You could do something about the workflow, helpful, but to see them develop together and to compare the differences, you'll come away with a lot better feeling for the two languages when you're doing exegesis.
And we've got to do an intensive study of the gift of interpretation of tongues and see if it can be applied there in the Catholic Middle Ages where a person receives an instantaneous understanding of language.
I'm going to sure use that sometime. A real good test of how you're getting this is to, I should give a test someday for fun, for those who want to take it. No credit, no nothing, after school's out or something like that. Where I give you some sentences in Hebrew and have you translate them into Greek.
That'd be fun.
It would be very interesting to see and pick ones that have some peculiar idiomatic structures. So you have to really make a judgment. You have to use an infinitive construct in Hebrew and participle Greek. So,
what you do is you have to write the last name. One of them has to translate it from the English into the Greek. So the guy gets the Greek portion. He has to translate it into Hebrew.
That would really be fun. That would
make a good
We have a grad student
fellowship.
Afterwards, you can do something like that. For our games,
You did what?
Well. Okay, let's go back to these prepositions with the infinitive construct. Both prepositions are common in these speech, but with certain verbs, especially shama and ra'ah, ka is by far the preferred preposition. So they seem to be both being used on many of these verbs, but some of them seem to have reference for one or the other. There are reasons founded in the aspectual nature of these verbs which determines this choice. But a catalog of uses would serve no purpose in an elementary grammar of this sort. So that's the kind of thing if you want do a study sometime in the future, and I don't really recall any books that I've seen, grammar books, except maybe Gesenius does go to, maybe has a section or something showing a verb preference for one or the other. I don't know. If he does, that's the only one I can think of. Otherwise, you'd have to compile a list for yourself, But fortunately, since we're going from Hebrew to English, we don't have to worry so much about deciding whether to use the or the. It'll already be there in the text. We'll know what it means. Okay, the infinitive with but or so is very frequent, and it's not a test if you use one or the other, I wouldn't have any problems. It's very frequent in the construction treated in section 110. So, why he, kishamoa, Abraham, and what Abraham heard. So here we can couple this with what we had before now. Before we had kasher and so a few things like this, now we've got another whole thing of careful modifier we stick in, the infinitive construct, and then still keep that in the series by putting the yi up front, or wahaya up front. So we can just add to our machinery for that. So, and when Abraham heard, so forth, and when you hear my voice, wahaya kishum shomacha et kuli. Then part B, with Lamas, the infinitive construct occurs in a wide variety of complementary and explanatory uses, often with a meaning of purpose, goal, or result. Can you see why that makes any sense?
Yeah.
Okay. Lamas meaning two, so you've got this idea of direction, you know, two or four, and that's very, and then the infinitive coming there to give the verbal concept. So they came to hear, see, Bahu the Shemoa. Very, that's probably the easiest, the easiest to relate to English, the way of thinking. I mean, it's pretty straightforward. If you haven't seen that before and you've looked at it, you probably translate it right. Maybe you would. By the way, there's a little footnote here. There's an interesting passage in, Genesis, I think it's 2:3. Where it says in the King James, all things that God created and made, and the Hebrew is created to make. And what they have is this preposition lamas with the la'asot, and here you actually see that part of la'asot, that part of that infinitive construct for asa. Now we haven't had three hays infinitive construct yet, but that's what one looks like. So it's funny he gave an example of something we haven't had. Oh, I guess he did put a parenthesis, yeah, infinitive book. Okay, he did tell you something about it. But anyway, that form occurs exactly in the text there. It means created to make. That means created and made. And Mahali got that translation. And most of the commentaries, you know, point out that but they don't know what to do with it. Their theology oftentimes doesn't know how to handle it. Created to make, what it means.
Well, now here he says by doing.
Mm-hmm.
So, is there a reason because...
Well, that's only because you have an object of the...
by doing righteousness.
Yeah, you have tzedek there. And you shall observe the way of the Lord. I suppose you could say to do righteousness. And I think that might even be better, just to be safe. You shall observe the way of the Lord to do righteousness.
Okay.
And of course, you see, that's kind of in English idiom, to do you shall observe the way to do righteousness. I mean, it's kind of a resultant idea, and then they get this by
doing. See, I wonder here, because...
This thing's going a little bit too far.
Here, yeah, when he puts by, little word that translates all the Greek prepositions. You know, it's agency.
Yes.
You shall observe the way of the Lord by doing righteousness. Says something different than you shall observe the way of the Lord to do righteousness.
Yes.
Because observing the way of the Lord will then be the means by which
right.
you will do righteousness.
Right.
Or else, doing righteousness is the way whereby you will observe the way of the Lord.
See, I would analyze this probably as a result. You will observe the way of the Lord to do righteousness. In other words, doing righteousness is the result of your observing the way of the Lord. Lord. Purpose, goal, and result.
Yeah.
And purpose, goal, and result, they all come, you know, pretty much the same.
Sure.
Realm. This, though, I think you've got a good point. By doing righteousness,
puts the cart before the horse.
Yeah, it does. It does put the cart before the horse.
What is, see, here it would be the doing of righteousness, really.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, because they, there's this law. What would it be? Look, I mean, there's a difference. Otherwise, they wouldn't put. You know, they would call them
Nazarenes. Yeah. But you can see this. You know, you shall observe the way of the Lord to the doing of righteousness is almost kind of the idea. Is that that's the result. You're observing the way of the Lord to the doing of righteousness.
Mm-hmm. Now, of course,
before the doing of righteousness.
Yeah, this is a
construct. Kind of the body becomes the following.
Oh, yeah.
Right. Well, it would be
so common. Oh, I see what you're saying. Yeah.
Well, yeah, you couldn't have an article.
You were saying that should have an article on. Okay, that's right. Okay.
That's right.
I'm looking at it more of the doing righteousness as just kind of a concept. In English, you almost put an article on it just because you're trying to deal with a conceptual thing. I'm not, you know, but this doesn't have the article. It definitely doesn't have the article.
I wonder if the article is here. I don't see it on the
And remember, too, that you do have a construct relationship as well. So the definiteness of the first would be determined by the second one anyway.
We have to say the doing to bring it over from
just about
into the.
Yeah, because we put it, when we put an ing on something, you almost have to do that to get the.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know. You see, you're getting into the same problem with budget because we're dealing with the boundary between two completely different languages that express things different ways. Maybe that's what he's thinking. It's hard to know just what the range of idioms are here until we see this about these things in use.
Mm-hmm.
All I can say is that from the experience that I've had, I'd be more inclined to say to the doing of righteousness. You shall show the way of the Lord to the doing of righteousness.
But how about that parallel arm phrase that we would normally use?
What would English normally use in a case like that? With the result of doing righteousness.
In order to do righteousness.
With the do to doing righteousness.
But you see, when we say to do, in English, it's almost one of those auxiliary things. To do righteousness. And to do isn't enough. We need that. It's almost like the object complements the righteousness. To fill out the idea. If it was a different verb, it might change things around.
Well, we'll have to watch in these exercises and so forth and gain the best sense we can from these.
I got my test back that day.
Oh, okay. You already get the test back.
I don't know. When it translates to me, I understand it has something to do with time. It seems to me that, preferably, in my standing to his face, there before their face, however one it's temporal, but not necessarily. When you say when, it takes on a different clarification of temporalness. Because it's in the realm of my standing. In the realm of the time of when I was standing.
I think it's just too the same kind of thing happens in Greek, too, when you get the preposition and oftentimes used in locative, and they'll say it's instrumental or something like that. But the idea is still a locative idea. I mean, you get to a spot where you say there's a real idea in Greek that's all the same. And in English, they're always dancing around with all these different translations, and it's usually because they're looking at it, trying to reduce the English idiom, and I just don't like it. The more you know about Greek and Hebrew, the less satisfied you are with those simplistic translations. Because what's happening is you're actually starting to take in the language. That's why you're having a problem with those English translations.
Yeah. It's convenient, but it's not truly convenient.
Right,
you know what I mean?
Exactly. And it's hard to see. If you want to get it right on, you either have to get a stupid form that the average person is not going to be able to relate to because he does still not see in his picture and he just sees some funny words you put together. Or you have to paraphrase it and say it a lot of different ways, and then you get an amplified translation,
The Rotherham or the amplified one.
Sure, right. But if nothing else, this will give you a real heart for translators. They're not malicious beings, most of them. Some of them are, but they're just trying to do the best they can with these idioms.
I know some people try to categorize it.
Yeah.
Once they look at it.